This week on The Clappers, community service announcements, public service announcements abound. We are your friend technologically and on the roads. Also, we talk about the best film I've never seen.
Several times.
Six Underground.
We talk about Motherless Brooklyn, Edward Norton's new and quite fascinating noirish thriller. And we talk about Hunters, which is on Amazon and causing a bit of a kerfuffle.
Oh, a kerfuffle. Welcome to The Clappers. This is Andrew Young.
And this is Carl Quinn.
Fresh from the 86, the 96 and the 112. That's pretty good stuff. Pretty good stuff.
Trams. Love the trams.
As a post-Fitzrovian, I'm not completely up to date with all the changes in the trams, but it's good that we have them and it's good that they're still here. So I made the attempt to change the plan that my household internet is on today.
Mm-hmm.
And it took an hour. And I have a transcript, which I won't share with you. But I tell you, I've previously spent an hour and gotten nowhere. So at least in this hour that I spent with my provider.
Mission accomplished. Well done.
I will now be saving $22 a month.
Yep.
And
how much is your hourly labor worth?
Well, that's the thing. It's worth in excess of $22.
I was trying to work out how many months worth of savings does this hour of labour equate to?
The problem is that the plan was a sound plan, but when it ended, I didn't notice this for a while.
Yeah.
The price skyrocketed.
Ah, one of those.
Okay, and which I think is quite mean. And I tried to deal with this and got nowhere. And so I thought, okay, I'll go online and do it myself, sort it out. All the information online is a little ambiguous and maybe even the word would be misleading.
Be careful with that word.
Well, I will tell you, I won't say the company, but the company has plans and it tells you how much they cost per month. All good, all normal. How many gigs you get, all fine. Then it tells you on a 24-month plan.
Right.
I thought, now that's interesting because this company has been boasting lately that you don't have to be on a 24-month plan. You can be on a month-to-month plan and no disadvantage to you. So I get into the chat room having a chat and, turns out you don't have to be on that. And it turns out you don't have to pay the extra cost that the website says you do. So it was worth my time and my pocket to do the chat. So you may be averse to it. You may would prefer to speak to a person, which will take you even longer. Trust me. If you need to make any changes to your plans, especially if the NBN has just come to your zone, then do the chat.
I once tried to book train tickets in England.
Right? Yes.
Staying with my parents who live in a satellite town outside Birmingham.
Yep.
Wanted to get the train to London from Birmingham. Easy. There are so many services.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's not that many services. Okay. It's basically a Virgin train service, right? But it goes quite frequently. There are so many ticketing options. Like I tried to book this ticket online and there were, I would swear, there were more than 100 options for the ticket with vastly
different variable prices
and restrictions. And, you know, on this one, you were not allowed to bring your own footwear. On this one, you know.
This one you have to kneel and bark like a dog.
Pretty much. In the end, I went, I'm giving up and buying it when I get to the station. It was just so much easier.
And you could.
Yeah, of course.
Well,
it's
good that you can because, you know, it's difficult for travellers who come to Melbourne and they realise they need this thing called a Mikey.
Yep.
It can
absolutely
be difficult.
Andrew?
Mm.
A movie called Motherless Brooklyn. Are you familiar with the novel by Jonathan Lethem?
I'm familiar with the author, but not that novel, no.
I've only read one of his novels, which was The Fortress of Solitude. Mm-hmm. And pretty interesting, odd kind of book with a slightly magical realist kind of superhero vibe, but not really. I mean, it's really about kids growing up in Brooklyn, right? Mm-hmm. Motherless Brooklyn is set in the 90s.
Mm.
But the film version, which is adapted by Edward Norton, who directs it, who produces it, who stars in it, is set in the late 1950s.
Yep.
So I think my understanding of it, having not read the book, my understanding is that Lethem uses a kind of clipped noirish kind of dialogue.
Okay.
And Norton's sort of take on this was that that kind of sat better with an earlier period setting.
Than contemporary.
Yeah. And what it gives him is the ability to actually dovetail his sort of detective story with a sort of, I guess you call it an expose of sorts, of corruption in town planning and building.
Nice.
And it's really pretty great.
Yeah.
It's a
well,
film
Chinatown's
that's sort of,
a bit like that, isn't
well,
it?
Well, Chinatown is the obvious echo yeah. in this film. I mean, you can't. I kept thinking this is so much in the same space as Chinatown, and not many films do that. I mean, you know, you could probably say Gomorrah does that. You could say there are a handful that try to sort of look at the way in which cities operate as almost a sort of, I guess a sort of an outcome of decision making that is not made with people's best interests at heart necessarily.
There is a season of The Wire.
Oh, of course,
that does that.
There are five seasons of The Wire,
but one of the seasons focuses just on the town hall and the politicians. Tommy Carcetti.
Season 3, I think that is, isn't it?
Yeah. So it, I think that's a fascinating subject.
Yeah.
Corruption is fascinating, but also political corruption is equally fascinating.
So Norton plays this character who's he has Tourette's syndrome.
Great.
So
I'm in. That's it. Just go and see this, everybody. Is it a film?
Yeah.
Go see the film, everybody.
So he's like a junior associate in a firm that of which Bruce Willis's character Frank is.
It's getting
the boss.
Better. It's getting better. What's he got? What's his affliction?
Shadiness, I think you'd have to say. And then Alec Baldwin plays the head of the planning department,
the head of the microwave division.
No, he's not at NBC, but he might as well be. But it's. It's great. It's a bit slow. Yeah. It's possibly a little bit too long. There are multiple strands that kind of interweave and sometimes feel like they're slightly red herring-ish and kind of go, I'm not sure if we're actually getting the payoff on that particular avenue. There's a guy who is a jazz musician, a trumpeter, African-American. The period's about 1957. He's developing this new style of playing that nobody's ever heard before. He's played by Michael Kenneth Williams, who played Omar in the aforementioned The Wire.
Yeah.
And he speaks with a really raspy kind of voice.
And modes. Is he working with modes?
It's basically Miles Davis. But it's never identified
said.
As
never
such.
Said, yep. Yep.
And it's just such a delight, this film, in so many ways. I think you would love it.
I can't wait.
There is a lot of jazz in the soundtrack.
It's got jazz. It's got actors that I really like.
Yep.
Are there any women in this film or is it just men?
There are women. There's a woman called Laura who is a sort of citizen activist, and she's sort of holding out against the redevelopment of areas of what are termed ghettos.
Yeah.
But in reality, they're just low-cost housing for African-Americans. And she's played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw. And there's Cherry Jones, who you might have seen. Did you ever see Transparent? She plays, again, another sort of a community activist.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of stuff about race, a lot of stuff about corruption, town planning, about ambition, about... But, you know, not writing people off for their flaws, particularly around Ed Norton's character. And it's, like I say, it's just, I think it's a really, really cool film. It's a really interesting thing. Feels very old-fashioned in some ways without being stodgy. Yep.
Okay, great. So, I'll go along.
That's Novelist Brooklyn.
So there's this film called Six Underground.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't either, but I will talk about it. I haven't seen it four times, to be accurate.
So that's only 4 days of your life when you've not seen it, or 4 days of your life when you've attempted to watch it but haven't?
I would say that it hasn't taken the whole period of a day, but what happens is sometimes I'll get home from work or a gig or something, it'll be late, and I go, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to watch a film, and I'll put it on. And then miraculously I will fall asleep before the end of the film. And
so it's a slow, quiet...
A gentle film by Michael Bay.
Who's renowned for his slow,
reminiscent
quiet,
of your...
reflective work.
Claire's Knee or the Eric Romer style films of the 70s. You know, gentle, soft, sweet, lyrical, poignant. And this film begins with a car chase through the streets of Florence. And it's a very...
When you say car chase, you actually mean motorized scooters that old people with disabilities use, right? Because, I mean, it is a gentle, reflective
yes, exactly.
Michael Bay film.
A Michael Bay film. Now, of course, I was being ironic. And we, where we are, we can do that. So it starts off with a car chase, and it's very bloody, and there's lots of explosions and crashes. It's a really exciting car chase, and I love a car chase, and I will give a film that might not be very good a bit more of a chance if it has lots of excitement in the motoring department. And ostensibly, this tech billionaire decides to pretend that he is deceased, fakes his own death, so that he can assemble a crack team of top men and women to go and take out dictators all over the world, assassinate them, murder them, kill them. And this is what they do. And it's very exciting and full of blood and gore and guts. And probably the thing about it that is attractive or interesting or fun, despite its gore, is Ryan Reynolds' nasty, bitchy mouth. He's really mean and rude and snide, and it's funny.
So basically he's playing the Deadpool character again.
Well, I haven't seen that. So I don't think I've ever seen him in any film, and I never knew who he was anyway because I always think about the other Ryans and, you know, Ryan O'Neill, Ryan's daughter, Von Ryan's Express, and the other one, Ryan Gosling.
Gosling.
So... This film,
I can
recommend in the sense that for as long as I've been awake, it's been enjoyable. But I wouldn't say it's a comment on the film. It's more a comment on my fast-paced metropolitan lifestyle
right. That
I'm falling asleep every time. Every time. A couple of times I've gone back to the start.
So you'd rate this film maybe 3.5 Zs? Is that where we're at?
I'd rate it a Z and 2 noughts. So... I'm not joking. You should, if it's on your streaming service, which is it is on Netflix, I would say try and pin your eyes open, get a nice strong cup of Joe, and watch it.
So you're suggesting that our listeners should watch Six Underground,
yes,
so that they can write to you and tell you how it ends.
Yes, that would be. I'd love that if somebody could please watch this film, because I don't trust myself. I'm going to get home tonight. And there's every chance I'm going to put it on again, and I'm going to get to that point where they're as dressed as tennis players. Don't need to tell you anymore. And I'm going to get to that point. I'm going to fast forward to where they're impersonating tennis players and hope for the best. But I don't like my chances, frankly.
Right.
I really don't.
Right. So I'm going to make a wild suggestion.
Do.
Why don't you just start it again from where you were up to?
That's what I'm doing.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. That's the point.
Oh, you're not going back to the beginning.
No, I'm saying to the part where they are tennis players in Vegas, which is maybe an hour in.
Yeah.
I'm going from there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go from there.
Right.
Okay.
No.
The first car chase scene, which I've seen a few times, is really cool.
I mean, you must have it off by heart by now.
I know. I know every part of the Uffizi. I've never been there. Every part. But yes, Six Underground, watch it. Now, motorists, when we were kids, Carl, there were always certain types of motorists you'd have to watch out for.
I don't know that I like where this might be going.
There were the motorists who wore hats.
Right.
There was a myth, perhaps, that men wearing hats in motor, because this was past the era where all men wore hats everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Men who wore hats while they were driving were slow plodders who would just do something unexpected and dangerous and you had to steer clear of them, right?
Yep.
And then
they were the Volvo drivers of their day.
Then the Volvo drivers became, and there's actually sound logic behind the Volvo driver being the dangerous driver.
Go on.
You could step in as a former Volvo driver.
Until very recently, a Volvo driver, I may take umbrage at this.
Volvos were always advertised as being extraordinarily safe cars.
Yeah.
The safest.
So
car
no matter how lousy a driver you were safe.
At least you would be okay. And this is the thing: they marketed themselves to the nervous, the shy, the anxious, the incompetent, the blind, those with hearing difficulties, those who were maybe decades past their usefulness as a motorist, people with no skills. They got Volvos, right? And there may well have been one or two Volvo drivers who were really good drivers and just liked them because they really were
just
really
one or
cars.
Two. Just one or two.
Well, yeah.
Single figures.
We knew one family, and the they were really into cars. They were good drivers. Right. And they had two Volvos. Yeah. So, right?
So when you say one or two,
they had
you knew them both.
Yeah. They had two each, a Volvo for the woman and a Volvo for the man.
Mm-hmm.
And the man also restored himself a Triumph TR4, which is a British sports car from the 60s. So these are people who talk my language.
Yeah, right, okay. So where are we going with this?
I'm going to tell you. So the Volvo obviously was supplanted by these huge soft Rovers that nervous people now drive, so they can be above all the traffic and be safe, but now they're actually at the same level as the traffic. Now, the thing to watch out for now, motorists of Melbourne, I don't know about the rest of the world, the maroon car. When you see a maroon car, just watch what it does. Watch what idiocy transpires. Watch what stupid, lazy, thoughtless, selfish motoring happens when you see a maroon car. And be careful. If you can hang back and let it go, do so. Don't put yourself in danger.
When it comes to motoring, you are hattist, markist, and colorist.
Yeah, right. Now, I'm going to go the Volvo thing, that's not – you can see a Volvo driver and not be scared of them anymore.
Right.
You can see someone wearing a hat now.
Yeah.
Don't be scared of them either.
Yeah.
Maroon cars.
Right.
Now, maroon is a word that people have. You know, we can say burgundy if you like. We could say vermilion.
Can we say maroon?
We could say maroon if you like, if you want. But I think you get the color I'm talking about. Mm. Oxblood, if we're talking footwear. Okay. So.
So if you see an oxblood shoe coming towards you on the road, get the hell out of there.
Those shoe cars are the worst.
You have so many prejudices.
Yes. However, in this case, we're talking about me making a judgment with all the evidence in front of me.
Rather than before.
Exactly. I didn't just decide one day, yeah, I bet it's those maroon cars.
So it's not a prejudice.
No.
It's a judice.
It's a subjudice.
A post-judice.
A post-judice. And yes, I want the people to be safe. Shoot me.
Oh, that's an invitation. If ever I heard one. I'm watching a show called Hunters. It's on Amazon.
Okay.
Amazon Prime. Yeah. Stars Al Pacino. That's the biggest name. He is the biggest name in it.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
And he doesn't do that so much. So people who have an issue with Al Pacino's sort of like big acting may... He tones it down. This is probably only about a 7.5 on the Pacino scale, the Pacinometer. And he's...
Is he going back to that whiny voice he used when Michael? He talked a little bit like that out of his nose.
I don't think he can do that anymore. Okay. He's you know, what is he, 78 or something? He's like, you smoked too many cigars over the years. So he's playing an elderly Jewish man living in New York in 1977, Maya Offerman. And Maya Offerman takes under his wing this young guy, Jonah Heidelbaum, who is played by Logan Lerman, whose grandmother is murdered in his house. And Jonah comes to suspect with some, you know, some validity that It was not an accident. It was not an opportunistic murder. She was assassinated.
Yep. Targeted.
Yeah. And so it turns out that Maya Offerman is the head of a group of Nazi hunters, and they're on the trail of former actual Nazis from the wartime who have been not only living in America but were brought to America by the U.S. government post-war. To work in medical research, in scientific facilities, at NASA, and so on.
And this happened.
Some of it happened. Yeah. It's the marketing around this has suggested based on a true story. I think that is it's based in the loosest possible way on
a true
story.
Nazis.
There were Nazis.
There were Nazi hunters.
Did go to, well, yeah.
Simon Wiesenthal, Nazi hunter.
That's right. So the suggestion is that Maya Offerman is kind of like a fictionalized or inspired by, Simon Wiesenthal, who was not the only one. There were others as well. But and you could say, yes, the idea of somebody who takes it on as his life mission to expose the crimes and the sort of the new identities and bring them to justice. Yes. But the justice in this is absolutely about slitting their throats or blowing their brains out.
Right.
It is a very visceral form of justice.
Like Munich.
Rather than sitting down in Den Haag and arguing the point for months and months and months to a crappy resolution. So it's a really interesting piece of work. It's come in for some criticism already.
I've seen the criticism.
Yeah, have you? Okay.
The human chess.
That's right. But that's in the first episode.
Yeah, there's a criticism that they've invented atrocities that never happened, and there are members of Jewish organisations associated with
the Auschwitz Museum, has tweeted about this
and say that this is really not good for preserving the memory and remembering accurately what happened. Yeah. Creating things that never happened just plays right into the hands of the Holocaust deniers.
Yeah,
and I get where they're coming from.
And it's a really interesting point, because I would say that the thing that this show is about more than anything is memory. Right, and not allowing people to forget what happened, what people did, keeping the history of it alive. Mm-hmm. David Weil, who's I think he's about 32 or something, who is the creator of this show, says that his grandmother was really the inspiration for this. It's a love letter to his grandmother who survived Auschwitz.
Yep.
And he heard her stories about Auschwitz and the good things that people did for each other and the horrors they faced. And he said, you know, she was his superhero. These sounded like wild adventure stories, you know, comic book kind of stories. Mm. And there is a real kind of comic book energy throughout this series, without it ever going into the kind of, you know, people flying through the air or whatever. And it's interesting, because I think that this notion of keeping the story alive and keeping the knowledge of what happened alive is very much what guides the show. Mm. But then there's this kind of, this fancy element about it, where it goes into fictional territory, like particularly that chess game scene, which, just by way of explanation, it's two teams effectively of Jewish prisoners who are set against each other, one being black, one being white. And then on either side of the board, somebody, and again, a Jewish prisoner, is playing the game at the behest of the Nazis, and they're moving the pieces. And when a piece gets taken, they're killed. So it's a horrific kind of cruel, manipulative kind of setup. And you look at it and go, it is the kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's the kind of thing that the Nazis did. But it's not actually a thing that they did.
Mm.
It has great visual impact. It is something that you see it, you'll never forget it.
Yeah.
But it's not true.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, he's created this thing that is going to speak to a younger audience, that is going to speak to an audience that would probably never watch documentaries about Auschwitz, that will probably not engage with this, that doesn't really want to know, that doesn't want to think about it in terms of how it relates to the world we inhabit right now.
Mm.
So is that a good thing or a risky thing?
I think it's a good... I think you can't have two bites of cherry, and too many shows are doing, or films, TV series are doing this, where they're based on, inspired by true... Just, it's a work of imagination. Make it a work of imagination. This is a fictional story based on something that really happened. If you want to have the credit for making a really great film or piece of work that is based on things that actually happened, then don't invent extra things for the sake of visual splendor or drama. There's enough that happened there to tell this story, what really happened, which is horrible, that I don't see the point in inventing things myself.
So I'm going to just pull you up on that a little bit, because I think the issue is around the marketing of it, right, as based on true events, right?
Yeah.
And I can't remember whether they actually say based on true events or...
Inspired by...
No, they do use the word based on.
Based on...
I'm trying to think if it's based on true events or based on a true story. I think it's probably true events is what they say. So you could say, yes, there's some true events, and yes, it is.
Well, there was an Auschwitz, sort of, there were, as you said.
That's right.
All these things exist.
Humans do exist. Yeah, you know, there is a planet Earth. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, it's being a bit fatuous. I mean, there's more in it that is anchored. And there is a lot of the show actually takes place in the past, in Auschwitz, in Berlin, in the UK in 1939. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that is historical and is more or less anchored in, historical fact, more or less being the operative term. I don't know that, because you're taking an historical framework as the world in which you tell your story, that you can only tell things that actually happen.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying you can't have it both ways. Well, if you want to make an imaginative work like Berlin, Babylon,
I think you can have it both ways.
Okay.
I think you can set a story in the world of you know, a world in which Nazism happened and people survived and they seek retribution.
Yeah.
But I don't know that you can only tell what happens from that point, you know, with all that historical background, that you can only tell what happened that actually did happen. I think you can go where you want with it. I mean,
Saying the same thing. I'm saying that you can have, like the Bernie Gunther novels, you can have fiction set in real times with real people and your fictional character moving through there with his own story that you've made up out of your mind, and that's called a novel.
Yeah.
And you can have films that are set.
Yeah.
And there's a TV show called Berlin Babylon, which is set in the Weimar period, and it's people that, you know, did happen, but also people that don't, and it's imaginative, and you can do it. And so I'm saying you can. You don't just have to have things that really happened in Auschwitz, but if you're purporting to tell a story that is based on...
So the issue...
Yeah.
We're in agreement on this.
Yes, we are.
That the issue is in saying based on...
We should buy a lottery ticket. Yeah.
That's, I agree with that.
We can have a show set anytime.
Yeah.
With anybody doing anything, so long as you don't pretend that it really happened. When
so
it
what
didn't.
I want to know is whether that's Amazon's marketing that's at fault, or whether that's David Weil, really the creator,
it really could
who's at fault.
And I somebody think should, it's the marketing. Somebody should respond, surely, to this quite serious and sound criticism of an aspect of a show. It's something that should be addressed.
I mean, I think it owes an enormous debt to, say, Inglourious Basterds, Tarantino's film. Well, yeah, in the sense of, like, violent... revenge upon Nazis.
Okay. Yep. You okay. Know, yep.
Of a sort that, to the best of our knowledge, never actually happened in the real world. So it's a wish fulfillment kind of fantasy, right? So I think
I get you. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I get that.
And there's also a kind of political, kind of comic, satirical element to it, which I detect. I mean, I don't know how much you've sort of put this home to him, but Jordan Peele, who wrote and directed Get Out and Us.
Okay, yep.
He's an executive producer on this. So how much of a sort of guiding hand he's had in that is hard to say. I mean, you can never tell. I mean, his name might be on there purely because it's a great marketing ploy, or it might be on there and it's sort of framed as if he's been a major figure in its guidance.
A major Figaro?
A major figure in its guidance.
A marriage of Figaro.
You can't say
Figaro and it not be pointed. You got to.
I didn't say Figaro. You did. I said figure.
I can't wait to go back and get this. It's going to be good.
Anyway, it's hard to know how much of a guiding hand he's had in it.
Yes.
But you certainly detect a certain element of it. Yeah.
When you first brought this up, I started thinking involuntarily. I did some involuntary thinking, remembering the first few pages of the book Marathon Man by William Goldman.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the film, of course. The book has a lot, like, they pretty much follow each other, but the book, there's a lot in the first few pages of these two men driving and a car crash and someone recognizing, I think the name is Zell, the former Nazi who is now living in...
I read this book when I was about 12. I'm astonished that you can remember much about it.
I think it's Otto Zell. I was about the same age. My dad had it, and I thought, this looks interesting.
Yeah.
And he gets recognised by some old Jews in the neighbourhood who were at the camp that he was, I think, the commandant of. And it's an amazing book and an incredible, terrifying film. And, you brought my memory back to that.
Nobody says, is it safe in this film,
series? Because it's not. Oh, man, that's frightening.
Anyway, Hunters, it's certainly problematic.
Really
it's challenging.
Is it?
I've watched 6 episodes of it out of 10, and I think it's really interesting.
Okay,
I mean, some of it I just think is a little bit sort of long-winded and a little bit sort of... a bit rambling, maybe.
I look forward to the response.
But I think it's interesting what it's trying to do.
Yep. Okay, cool. That's it for the clappers. Thank you for listening. You can catch up with us anywhere you get your podcasts. And Carl's put something nice up on the Facebook page, I believe.
Have I?
Yeah, I think a link to our last episode.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, you can like us and befriend us.